This is Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo, number 294 on CFUR, 88.7 FM in Prince George, rebroadcast hither and yon. The United States has won the war against Iraq. Their oil ministry has opened exploitation of their vast reservoirs of petroleum to foreign corporations. And isn't that what the war has been all about? A million or so Iraqi deaths from bombs, bullets, and disease was not too great a price to pay for this victory. The dubious government of Iraq has granted the U.S. permission to keep soldiers in the country for a couple more years, and that will, of course, be extended, as there's no doubt that the installations constructed in the country were meant to be permanent. American soldiers will be withdrawn from populated areas by June, but they will be stationed permanently near the oil wells and pipelines to protect their oil resources. Afghanistan's also declared to be a triumph for forces of the Coalition of the Killing, even though the so-called Taliban control three-quarters of the country. Some victory. Experts claim that it would take tens of thousands more soldiers to control the country, and Bush, in the dying years of his wretched regime, has promised 20,000. So far, it looks like Obama will fulfill his threat. Even though the invasion of Afghanistan was billed as a campaign to eliminate al-Qaeda from the country, and it seems they've been driven to Pakistan, the war goes on. All justifications are cast aside, and the only goal left is the total crushing of the country's resistance to occupation. So much for hearts and minds. This is about demonstrating sheer military power. In these days of endless war, I think it appropriate to reach back just over a century to resurrect Mark Twain's satirical comment on the wars of his time and their righteous supporters. This work is entitled The War Prayer. It's available for downloading from several sources on the Internet. It was a time of great and exalting excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating. The bands playing, the toy pistols popping, the bunched firecrackers hissing and sputtering. On every hand and far down the receding and fading spread of roofs and balconies, a fluttering wilderness of flags flashed in the sun. Daily the young volunteers marched down the wide avenue, gay and fine in their new uniforms, the proud fathers and mothers and sisters and sweethearts cheering them with voices choked with happy emotion as they swung by. Nightly, the packed mass meetings listened, panting, to patriot oratory, which stirred the deepest deeps of their hearts, and which they interpreted at the briefest intervals with cyclones of applause, and the tears running down their cheeks the while. In the churches, the pastors preached devotion to flag and country and invoked the God of battles, beseeching his aid in our good cause and outpourings of fervent eloquence, which moved every listener. It was indeed a glad and gracious time, and the half-dozen rash spirits that ventured to disapprove of the war and cast a doubt upon its righteousness straightaway got such a stern and angry warning that for their personal safety's sake they quickly shrank out of sight and offended no more in that way. Sunday morning came. Next day the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams, visions of stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. Then home from the war, bronzed heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in the golden seas of glory. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, to win for the flag, or failing, die the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building. With one impulse, the house rose with glowing eyes and beating hearts and poured out that tumultuous invocation. God the all-terrible, thou who ordainest, thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it for passionate pleading and moving and beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever-merciful and benign Father of us all would watch over our noble young soldiers and aid, comfort, and encourage them in their patriotic works. Bless them, shield them in the day of battle and the hour of peril. Bear them in his mighty hand. Make them strong and confident, invincible in the bloody onset. Help them to crush the foe. Grant them that, and to their flag and country, imperishable honor and glory. An aged stranger entered and moved with slow and noiseless steps up the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face, pale, unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness. With all eyes following him and wondering, he made his silent way. Without pausing, he ascended to the preacher's side and stood there waiting. With shut lids, the preacher, unconscious of his presence, continued with his moving prayer, and at last finished it with the words uttered in fervent appeal, "Bless our arms, grant us the victory, O Lord our God, Father and protector of our land and flag." The stranger touched his arm, motioning him to step aside, which the startled minister did, and took his place. During some moments, he surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes in which burned an uncanny light. Then, in deep voice, he said, "I come from the throne, bearing a message from Almighty God." The words smote the house with a shock. If the stranger perceived it, he gave no attention. "He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it, if such be your desire, after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import, that is to say, its full import. For it is like unto many of the prayers of men, in that it asks for more than he who utters is aware of, except he pause and think. God's servant and yours has prayed his prayer. Has he paused and taken thought? Is it one prayer? No, it is two, one uttered, the other not. Both have reached the ear of him who heareth all supplications, the spoken and the unspoken. Ponder this, keep it in mind. If you would beseech a blessing upon yourself, beware, lest without intent you invoke a curse upon a neighbor at the same time. If you pray for the blessing of rain upon your crop which needs it, by that act you are possibly praying for a curse upon some neighbor's crop which may not need rain and can be injured by it. You have heard your servant's prayer, the uttered part of it. I am commissioned of God to put into words the other part of it, that part which the pastor and also you in your hearts fervently prayed silently and ignorantly and willingly. God grant that it was so. You heard these words, grant us the victory, O Lord our God. That is sufficient. The whole of the uttered prayer is compact into these pregnant words. Elaborations were not necessary. When you have prayed for victory, you have prayed for many unmentioned results which follow victory, must follow it, cannot help but follow it. Upon the listening spirit of God fell also the unspoken part of the prayer. He commanded me to put it into words. Listen. O Lord, our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth into battle. Be thou near them, with them in spirit. We also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord, our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with little children to wander unfriended in the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst, sports of the sun flames of summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love of him who is the source of love and who is the ever-faithful refuge of friend in all that are sore beset and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. After a pause, ye have prayed it, and ye still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High waits. It was believed afterward the man was a lunatic because there was no sense in what he said. In 1965, Canada and the United States signed the deal that was to become known as the Auto Pact. Under this agreement, manufacturers were required to maintain an agreed ratio of production to sales in Canada, thus guaranteeing domestic auto production by subsidiaries of American companies. Then, in 1987, Lyon Bryan tied us into his notorious free trade agreement with the U.S., scuttling the protections of the Auto Pact, leaving us to the tender mercies of the Big Three to decide where and what to produce in Canada and elsewhere. In succeeding decades, we've relied upon incentives and bribes to companies to influence where vehicles would be produced. Today, Chrysler Corporation of Canada is demanding $1.6 billion from the Ontario and federal governments as emergency financial help for their teetering company. They're using potential American aid to the parent company as a lever to extort this aid. They claim that U.S. funds may contain a condition that more vehicles be built down there to maintain jobs, and that two assembly plants in Canada are at risk of closing, unless. When the mafia makes an offer like this, the law considers it blackmail. When corporations do it, it's blackmail. Cough up the money or 8,000 jobs will go south. What they're demanding is that Canadian taxpayers buy those jobs at $200,000 each. Let's see how governments react to this thinly veiled threat. This will reveal who is in charge, the people or the corporations. While our government ponders following other nations and bribing huge corporations to maintain facilities on their lands, Renault has discovered a path to success that doesn't involve extortion. Their subsidiary in Romania, Dacia, produces cars in a suburb of Bucharest that are being snapped up across Europe. They produce three basic models that have nothing in common with the former products of Eastern Europe, like the Yugo, the Skoda, and the Trabant. These cars are not pretty, but they're well-engineered, safe, reliable, and fun to drive. Besides, they're inexpensive, and this cannot all be laid on cheaper labor. The Dacia models, a hatchback, sedan, and a station wagon, run from $15,000 to $20,000. Last year, they sold 230,000 of these vehicles. They have 50% fewer parts than the high-end Renaults. They have few gadgets. The big three producers are geared to crank out leather-clad monsters and are addicted to the massive profits from these street hogs. Will they change their spots and use multi-billion-dollar government bribes to make the kind of cars that the world needs and the people want? We shall see. We're coming to the season where people traditionally make resolutions. It's a great time to be selling gymnasium memberships and exercise machines. As a corollary, around April is a fine time to buy slightly used athletic equipment. This is also a favorite time to attempt to quit smoking, something more easily resolved than accomplished. I started sneaking cigarettes when I was 14, and I was soon hooked. At 16, I was sent off to a boarding school where kids were allowed to smoke in a designated room, but only with parental permission. After sneaking smokes for a couple of months, I begged my parents for that coveted permission during Christmas break at home. They, both being heavy smokers, granted my wish. A few years later, I was a soldier and a two-pack-a-day smoker when I tried to quit several times. You may find this hard to believe, but the deciding factor was the expense of cigarettes. With my habit, I was spending almost 20% of my disposable income on smokes. In the post-exchange, I was paying 98 cents for a carton of 10 packs. I was burning a whole $5 a month out of my net pay. One morning, I steeled myself to really try to quit. I would not have a weed before breakfast. Then I would hold off until I got to work, then until coffee break, and then lunch, and so on through the day. I carried on like this all day, but the gut-wrenching urge for a smoke hit hardest after dinner. I tried exercise, running around the perimeter of our parade ground until I was exhausted. I found that if I could barely breathe, I had no desire to dilute my oxygen with smoke. For weeks, I carried on this routine until the habit was under control and I began to think of myself as a non-smoker. After the Army, I re-entered college. One night, I was in a car full of students when we were hit from behind and I was knocked cold. I awoke to find myself flat on the ground, surrounded by people and flashing lights. Some SOB in the crowd handed me a cigarette, and from that moment, I was right back to two packs a day. That old habit returned as though I had never paused. A couple of years later, I went through the whole routine of quitting, with the evening running and all. Tobacco addiction is one of the hardest to break. Heroin addicts say it is more difficult to quit the demon weed than smack. Smoke from modern cigarettes contains as many as 500 chemical compounds, several of which are addictive. When one quits smoking, he or she is dumping a whole set of habits, not just chemical, but social, oral, and manual. If you're a wannabe ex-smoker, I suggest you try my method. Do it 1 hour at a time, exercise when the urge is overwhelming, and then try to avoid places and situations that you associate with smoking. For a while, keep your distance from smokers, you know. I found that many feel threatened by people trying to quit. It makes them feel inferior, and they'll try to induce quitters to have just one. like a drink to an abstaining alcoholic. There's no such thing as just one cigarette. If you're working on becoming an ex-smoker, I wish you strength, as luck has nothing to do with your battle. It won't be easy, but success carries great rewards, making it worthwhile. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. I haven't bought a copy of the Prince George Citizen since the last time I trained a puppy, but I occasionally see a copy laying around. Last week, I caught the following headline on a stray copy. It read, "Police report no major accidents." Will we soon see such headlines as, "Russia doesn't bomb Italy," "Harper is not an axe murderer"? Could I get a job at the Citizen reporting non-news? Obama's new old choice for American Secretary of War, Bill Gates, is not so subtly suggesting that Canada extend our commitment of soldiers to the never-ending war against Afghanistan. Well, the public statements are kind of subtle, but I'm sure the orders are being issued to our own Minister of War, Peter MacKay. Harper gave an ironclad promise to the Canadian public and Parliament that we would withdraw troops from that war in 2011. Of course, that was just a promise, and promises by a Harper government have proved to be totally worthless. We've left over 100 dead in this mission so far, and we have a lot of soldiers left, so why not stay as participants in a hated occupation? Harper's hard-nosed relations with the world has already destroyed our reputation, so what have we left to lose but a few lives and billions of dollars? Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms is clear. Section 8 reads as follows. Everyone has the right to be secure against unreasonable search and seizure. We're supposed to be safe from arbitrary interference in our innocent daily affairs. Unless police have some overt indication of an illegal act, they are not to search us or our property. Period. What part of this do government legal eagles not understand? Our precious freedom is under attack. The Supreme Court of Canada is pondering a case that should be a slam dunk for being thrown out without comment. The facts are not disputed. A police officer in Ontario stopped a rental vehicle when the cop became suspicious of its driver. The suspicious action was driving legally at exactly the speed limit. A search under protest revealed a large amount of cocaine. The question before the court is whether the evidence is retroactively excused the illegality of the search. A search all the more odious as the officer lied in court as to his reasons for intercepting the vehicle's innocent passage. Unless the Supreme Court throws out this case, they're negating the meaning of Section 8 of the Charter absolutely. Upholding the use of this tainted evidence would grant license to police for fishing expeditions on the slightest of suspicions, or none. If they find nothing, maybe an apology is in order. If they do find evidence of wrongdoing, it excuses the violation of your rights. The Offender's Defense Counsel said, "By allowing evidence to be used when an offense is serious, the courts invite police to break the law with impunity. The seriousness of the offense is not a trump card. One cannot ignore the seriousness of the charter breach because one is dazzled by the evidence, yet that is what is happening in this case. Thus are our hard-won rights being whittled away from under us as we have our heads in the sand." Harper's party has neither principles nor policies. They profess to have such, but conservatives are flexible and willing to revise or dispose of them at whim. The old Reform Party, spore of Canada of today's conservatives, now bereft of any atavistic progressive elements carried over from their progressive conservative partner, was built on certain professed principles. As the former head of the Citizens Coalition, Harper was a staunch advocate of a triple E Senate. One of those E's was elected. No more governor general appointments under the advice of a prime minister. Harper promised when they took power, senators would be elected just like members of the lower house. However, the method of appointing senators is enshrined in Canada's constitution. Harper declared that his appointments would be made only after individual provinces elected candidates. He followed through on this when Alberta elected its choice of senator, but that was Alberta, and Alberta chose a right-wing candidate to Harper's liking. When it came to other provinces, that was another promise. Like other policies and promises, this one can be shucked easily by the man of no real principles. He intends to load the Senate with 18 new members before Christmas, and these will not be selected as the best qualified to serve Canada. These, he said, will be political hacks whose main qualification is that they will work to change the Constitution so that henceforth new members will be elected. This stinks on more than one level. he will appoint men and women who advocate undermining Canada's constitution. Meanwhile, Harper ridicules the pending coalition because it is supported by the Bloc Québécois. He distorts the BQ's quiet acquiescence by implying this is treason, while his dumping hacks into the Senate who don't support the Constitution is patriotism. Anyone who swallows any two words that Harper strings together believes in the tooth fairy. He will not run a deficit. He will not subsidize private industry. He will not tax income trusts. He will not sell off Canada's infrastructure heritage. Bull. He can hide subsidies with government guarantees of private loans to chosen industries, thus deferring bookkeeping entries to subsequent governments, which will have to cover inevitable defaults. He will run deficits unless he makes unacceptable cuts to government programs or sells off private public property. Hogwash all of his policies and promises. An old friend was a member of the Federal Parole Board in the Lower Mainland. He told me that he was sick to death of prisoners pleading for release because they had found Jesus in prison. It's common for incarcerated folk to try using religion as a path to freedom. My experience in the local lockup indicated that a greater percentage of prisoners are religious than are people on the street. Whether this is cause or effect is moot. What appears to me is that many people find Jesus behind bars. Could this be because Jesus was a friend of outcasts? That's another moot point. It appears that one may not only find Jesus in jail, but one may actually go to jail for finding Jesus. A young woman, age 18, in Wellington, Florida, is a case in point. She found Jesus, or at least a Jesus, in a Christmas creche on the community center lawn. She scooped him and took him home, where she was located by the police following the signal from a GPS transmitter embedded in the statue. Such devices are becoming common as more creches are vandalized and robbed. So be careful where you find your Jesus. Speaking of deviousness, look at David Emerson, former CEO of Canfor Forest Products, proud sponsor of UNBC's own Canfor Theater. He entered federal politics and was elected as a Liberal by the good folks in a Lower Mainland riding. After a term in which he worked unsuccessfully to negotiate a softwood lumber agreement with the United States, he ran again and won his seat. No sooner had he won than he was persuaded to cross the aisle and join the Liberals' nemesis, the Harper Conservatives, with a portfolio in which he negotiated the softwood lumber agreement with the United States. He was roundly repudiated by those who thought they had voted Liberal and got a Conservative. Spoil sports. So thoroughly was he rejected as a turncoat that he figured it would behoove him to retire from federal politics. Ah, but you can't keep a good traitor down. He's back in politics on a provincial level now, as Gordon Campbell appointed him to serve on the public payroll as the head of a provincial economic advisory council. This shift from Liberal to Conservatives back to Liberal is not as drastic as it appears. British Columbia's Liberal Party is actually a branch of the Federal Conservatives, having little in common with their federal namesakes. But what the hell, as CEO of Canfor, member of Parliament for the Liberals and the Conservatives, and now the provincial Liberals, he has constantly served the same masters, corporate Canada, to the detriment of the Canadian people. The Quran forbids observant Muslims from charging interest on loans. This was forbidden also to Christians as recently as Shakespeare's time, when it was left to Jews like Shylock to be moneylenders. For Christians or Muslims, there was no profit in lending. Has the United States Treasury begun borrowing from Muslims or medieval Christians? It would seem so, as the latest issue of the four-week U.S. Treasury bills bears 0% interest. And the auction for this issue was oversubscribed by investors eager to park their money in instruments perceived as safe. The only things I can see that would drive people to invest money without interest would be a belief in coming deflation of prices or an appreciation of the U.S. dollar. As to the latter, I cannot believe that U.S. currency will rise in comparative value, considering that they are shoveling it out the door of the Treasury as fast as it can be printed. Hyperinflation would be the textbook result of such folly, but we threw out the economic textbooks long ago. That leaves deflation, where money will buy more tomorrow than today. So why buy now? In spite of the dismal record of economic predictions from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they're going out on a limb estimating that Canada's GDP will grow by 2.1% in 2010. Say, aren't these the guys who said oil would be selling for $200 a barrel now? How in the world, with economic variables going nuts now, can this batch of clowns nail down a growth figure 2 years in the future to the nearest tenth of a percentage point? This is what comes of taking a field that is as much psychology as mathematics and trying to sell it as a science. Here's the countdown for today. Only 35 days until George Wanker Bush hands the presidency of the United States to Barack Hussein Obama, and in the process, loses his sovereign immunity from prosecution. Evidence is ample to lay charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity against this dreadful character. He's arguably guilty of the supreme war crime as defined by the United Nations Charter, Article 2, Section 4, which states, quote, "All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state." It doesn't take a Philadelphia lawyer to see that George Bush, in his gratuitous attack on Afghanistan in 2001, violated this sacred prohibition. Perhaps a stronger case against the Bush regime is their documented authorization of torture in Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and myriad secret dungeons around the world. This is in direct violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 5, reading, "No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment." Similar wording is stated as Article 7 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights, and the Geneva Conventions of 1949. Without the benefit of a legal background, it appears to me that there's ample cause to drag Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and a host of others before the International Criminal Court or an ad hoc tribunal for trial as flagrant violators of international laws, customs, and standards. If any were to protest that their authorized methods of robust interrogation and general treatment of prisoners were humane, let the courts replicate the treatments and living conditions for the defendants and then gauge their opinions after a few weeks of frequent flyer treatment, stress positions, sleep and sensory deprivation, solitary confinement, noise exposure, hooding, binding and gagging, and some of the other cute techniques contrived by official sadists of the United States government. This has been the 294th opening of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo, carried reluctantly on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Good night, sleep tight.